Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
Welcome to a special edition of On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A day after President Trump incited an insurrectionist mob that attacked the United States Capitol building, voices are rising in support of removing Trump from office. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi this afternoon.
In calling for this seditious act, the president has committed an unspeakable assault on our nation and our people. I join the Senate Democratic leader in calling on the vice president to remove this president by immediately invoking the 25th Amendment.
Only a few Republicans have joined that call. Most still stand by Trump, like South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham.
Well, then I don't support an effort to invoke the 25th Amendment now. If something else happens, all options would be on the table. But I hear from Schumer and Pelosi, just political talk.
But in his half-hour press conference, Graham spent considerable time speaking directly to members of Trump's cabinet, urging, even begging them to stay surrounding the president. Also, when asked about the future of the Republican Party, twice, with more than a hint of uncertainty or trepidation, Lindsey Graham said this.
I'm not worried about the next election. I'm worried about getting through the next 14 days. We'll talk about 2022 and 2024. Let's get Vice President Biden sworn in January the 20th.
So what are Americans to make of all this? The attack, the confusion, the bewilderment that democracy can be so quickly assaulted.
It disturbed me so deeply to watch our country just disintegrate before our eyes almost.
We actually had to turn off the television in our living room and go in another room because our granddaughter that lives with us was so upset.
I remember when September 11th happened, watching those planes hit the towers and watching this unfold on live media yesterday just brought all of those memories flooding back.
You're used to seeing this in other parts of the world. You're used to seeing this across oceans. And I hope that we can recover from this as a people and as a country and come together.
Those are just a few of the many On Point listeners we've been hearing from. Call us at 617-353-0683 to leave us a message about your thoughts now about this moment in America's history and about what you would like to see moving forward. Because this hour, we are going to speak with prize-winning historians and journalists about how they're thinking through this unprecedented, truly unprecedented moment in U.S. history and how they believe the nation can move forward. Well, Stephen Henderson joins us from Detroit. He is the host of WDET's Detroit Today and executive editor of Bridge Detroit. Stephen, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
Also with us is David Blight. He's professor of history at Yale University and director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. He is the author of Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, which won the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for History. Professor Blight, welcome back to you.
Hi, Meghna. Great to be back with you.
Is there another moment in U.S. history, Professor Blight, that you look to that can help us think through what's happening in this country right now?
Well, the closest thing to me, I'm afraid I have to say, is the secession crisis of 1860 and 61. There have been lots of allusions to the 1876 election and the compromise of 1877, which is what Ted Cruz apparently was modeling and calling for some kind of electoral commission. But that was a genuinely disputed election. There were three states with two separate sets of counts of their votes. This is not a disputed election. This is a contested election. There's nothing disputed about this election. It's over. We have a clear winner. It's certified. It's contested, though, by those who lost. And that's what happened in the secession crisis. However, rather than somehow contesting the election, of course, seven states of the Deep South between late December and February 1st in 1860-61 took the, you know, by far unprecedented step of seceding from the Union. I do think there is a parallel to what 130 or 40 Republicans have been doing in the U.S. Congress in supporting this effort by President Trump to discredit the election and discredit Biden. They have been practicing a kind of disunion from within the government. And yesterday's events, unfortunately, were a shocking result of that process.
Practicing a kind of disunion. Stephen, you've been on our show many times. And I remember, I think a month or so ago, you said, somewhat apologetically, you basically said, you're sorry, but you feel that there are profound divides, disunions in values in this country that may not be able to be bridged.
Mm-hmm. I still feel that way. I might feel that way a little more today than I did 2 days ago because of what we've seen in Washington. I think that there are at the core of many Americans' beliefs a separation, a distance that at least right now cannot be bridged. And I think that the folks who did what they did yesterday in Washington are an example of that. That's certainly how they feel, I think. And they are being manipulated, used by a political party that has not just for the last 4 years, but as I said on our show here in Detroit today, for the last five decades, has exploited that feeling for its own advantages, hasn't done a whole lot to help those folks out and the despair that they have, but certainly has used their votes to maintain power and execute a broader agenda. And I think we may have reached a point where this is not fixable. There is too much advantage in this separation. There's too much advantage in this division for the political infrastructure to turn its back on it. And I guess I don't expect to see that happen, even though yesterday shocked everyone's conscience, right? I think there was no one who watched what happened yesterday who wasn't surprised by this. But watch over the next week or the next month how much changes in a substantive way because of it. My guess is not very much.
Well, the fixability is something we're going to come back to in depth in a moment. But Professor Blight, one of the many, many images that's going to stay with me from yesterday for the rest of my life is the image of the flag of the Confederacy billowing in the halls of the United States Congress.
Yes.
I mean, you've spent your life, your professional career studying the profound wound of slavery in this country. And not until January 6th, 2021, did that flag ever fly in the capital of the United States. Can you tell me what you felt when you saw that?
My first feeling was extreme depression in the moment. I wasn't shocked because I'd been seeing all these other images of people carrying four different kinds of flags. They had the Gadsden flag. They had the American flag. They had 1,000 Trump flags and then this Confederate flag. Behind that man carrying the flag and that now, I guess, iconic photograph, I posted it up on Twitter myself with a comment, is a portrait of John C. Calhoun. Mm. Across from it is a portrait of Charles Sumner, the great abolitionist from Massachusetts. And the bust you will see in that picture is none other than Richard Nixon, which is an interesting mix in that photograph. To me, it brought back the terrible legacy of the lost cause tradition, the Confederate lost cause tradition, which has never gone away. It is sustained as a story, a set of beliefs in search of a history that doesn't really exist. We have thought in the past couple of years that at least some of that lost cause tradition, this ideology that claimed the South had not fought for slavery and they had fought for a noble cause, had been eroded in all the efforts to take down Confederate monuments and so forth. But there it was, a huge Confederate flag inside the Capitol being used by rioters who had taken over the halls of the Capitol.
Well, and now it's married to a new lost cause, is it not? The lost cause
it absolutely is.
The presidency of Donald Trump.
It absolutely is wedded to a new lost cause. And Meghna, I have just finished this afternoon on a new op-ed for the New York Times called The Trump Lost Cause. So in a day or two, that should be out, in which I tried to show that though it is not the same thing by any means as the Confederate lost cause, this lost cause is not rooted in sacrifice and warfare. It's not wedded or rooted in a cult of martyrs, at least not yet. But it is a story, a narrative, looking for a history. And all lost causes, whether it was the French after the Franco-Prussian War, or the Germans in the 1920s after their so-called stab in the back with the aftermath of World War I, or the Southern lost cause, lost causes are always rooted in big and little lies. Mm. And this one surely is.
Well, we are talking about how to think through, how to understand the past 24 hours and the past 40, 50, 60, 70, even 200 years that led to this point in American history. We'll be back with much more. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point, a special hour of On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are trying to begin to make sense of all that has happened to this country that was focused in the locus of violence in the attack on the Capitol building yesterday by an insurrectionist mob that were supporters of President Trump. Now, we've been hearing from many listeners that they point the blame not just on the incitement of President Trump, but on the behavior and decisions and politics and policy of his party, of the Republican Party writ large. So here's some of those listeners.
All those people present who passed the boundaries at the Capitol, all those lawmakers who supported those people need to be prosecuted and jailed.
The people in Congress, Josh Hawley and his gang, Ted Cruz, they need to be censured. They need to be put out of business because they're in the business of destroying America.
What are the consequences going to be for Congress, for the Republican congressmen, not just in the Senate, but also the 120 in the House who voted to go with the objection?
And no longer should Trumpites be let off the hook. This is anarchy. Sheer anarchy.
Some On Point listeners we heard from today. Call us at 617-353-0683 to have your say. Stephen Henderson, we have the Josh Hawleys, Ted Cruz's of the world who, even after the Capitol building was attacked, continued to dispute the legitimate outcomes of this election yesterday evening. At the same time, we had Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. We had Senator Lindsey Graham, who said no, the election has been decided. And Lindsey Graham today, even in his somewhat bewildering press conference, he was absolutely clear on the fact that he actually feels that the Republican Party is going to need to reassess, where its core is right now. And he said, get back to conservative principles of blocking and tackling. So, I mean, what do you see in that tension? Is one wing of this party, do you think is stronger than the other right now?
So I think there's a bigger problem here inside the Republican Party. And it's a problem that indicts everybody who considers themselves a Republican or a conservative in this country. I opened our show in Detroit today talking about the legacy of courting and coddling this extremist, this racist, this retrograde part of the Republican Party on the part of its establishment. And I started the timeline, I probably could have gone back even earlier, but I started the timeline with Ronald Reagan's announcement of his candidacy in 1980, which most Republicans would point to as sort of a high point for their party, this sort of visioning forward to free markets and the opportunity and the other things that Reagan liked to talk about. But the locale for that announcement, the place he announced his candidacy, for me, has always stood out more than anything that he said. He announced his candidacy in Neshoba County, Mississippi, a place where civil rights workers, it's only famous for one thing. It's for the Mississippi burning murders there in the Freedom Summer of 64. Ronald Reagan wasn't from Mississippi. He was from Illinois. Ronald Reagan was governor of California and a popular Hollywood actor. Why not choose those places to announce your candidacy? There was an intentionality there, and it was a wink and nod intentionality, but over time it has grown to a more brazen embrace of bigotry and racism and violence. You go forward from that to his characterization of welfare queens, the racialization of the social safety net, which he is principally responsible for in this country. You go forward from that to George H.W. Bush absolutely decimating Michael Dukakis by running an ad about Willie Horton, highly racialized ads. Yesterday in Georgia, the two Senate runoff races featured Republican candidates who did unspeakably racist things in their campaigns. They darkened the skin of Raphael Warnock in an ad. They lengthened the nose of John Ossoff, a Jewish Democratic candidate. This has become a critical part of Republican politics. It is what helps enable them to hold power and execute their agenda. And until that's dealt with, until that is disavowed by the core of the party, this is an inevitable outgrowth. What we saw yesterday is the end game of what Reagan in many ways started. And I use that term you know, loosely. Mm. He did not start it in explicit terms. But, you know, Donald Trump is linearly connected to Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. And I know Republicans don't like it when liberals say that. But I don't know that there's another way to characterize it that would be true.
Well, David Blight, would you characterize it similarly?
Oh, I would indeed. In fact, Ronald Reagan, despite all the glorious revisionism that goes on about him, was the single most racially divisive president in modern American history until Trump. There's just, in the record itself, there's simply no question about that. And I agree with Stephen on virtually all of this. But I would add to it, let's not forget the George W. Bush administration. Mm-hmm. The voter suppression efforts we have been witnessing that have now just exploded out into the open over and over and over again by the Republican Party began in a concerted way, in modern times at least, in the first Bush administration, in the Justice Department run by John Ashcroft, where he created a whole wing of that department of lawyers, the function of which was to go out and find voter fraud, which they could not find. Voter suppression has become a modus operandi of the Republican Party, basically because of their fear of demographics, their fear that as the largely white people's party, they're running the risk of losing elections because there aren't going to be enough white people. Okay. It's also that they have built their modern identity. And here again is why Reagan is so important. They have built their modern identity on hating government, of not believing in government, of discrediting government. Whereas the Democratic Party, it's a harder argument to make, has tried to build its modern identity on its New Deal legacy, which is the use of government to improve the lives of people, to improve the environment, to improve the climate situation, etc. So, yeah, this Republican Party has a lot of soul searching to do. But this has been the case after every time they're defeated. They had the so-called postmortem obituary after 2008. And what came of that? Trumpism. What they have now, though, is this virulent, government-hating, white supremacist core of their constituency, which comes not entirely from a white working class. There's a lot of educated people involved in that, too. But it is something Trump, in his brand of populism, has stoked to the point that he has made it the core of the Republican Party. And hence you've got all these Republicans trying to figure out a way to appeal to that base and still be what they think is something called conservative. Mm. I am not going to predict what's about to happen to the Republican Party. Actually, I will try one. And that is, I'll wager, you know, $3 with somebody that the Republican Party will come out of this basically just fine. They will unify again, all that terrible division they have. And it is real division right now over what happened yesterday and what happened with the 140-some voting to overturn the election. But as soon as they have legislation to oppose by the Biden administration and by now a Democratic majority, whether it's on climate or it's on voting rights or whatever it is, they will unify in a hurry to oppose it.
Well, Professor Blay, I would say that I think there's also electoral evidence that the Republican Party is doing just fine. You talked about every time they get defeated,
right.
and yet in this past election, they gained seats
right.
in the House. The Republicans,
they won everything but the presidency.
Correct.
And they didn't win Georgia.
They're doing very well. I mean, Republicans have many of the state houses across
yes.
the country and governor's seats as well.
Right.
So, but what does that tell you here?
Well, it tells us that they still have a lock on certain segments of the electorate. For example, they have a lock on what I call the tax bracket Republicans or the stock portfolio Republicans. They don't trust Democrats with their stock portfolios. I actually know many people like that. They have a lock on suburbanites who fear cities, although not quite the lock they used to have. They have a lock on a lot of white people who will never vote for Democrats because Democrats have become this hugely pluralistic party. And we just have to admit here, as much as some may not want to in the academy and other places, that there is a lot of deep conservatism in this country, especially in rural America, especially in certain regions of the country where you have a lot of voters who were no doubt turned off by Trump. You could see them interviewed on television, but they still voted for him. Now, the biggest fear I have is that this kind of populism, and Trump showed it can work. What if the next Republican populist is a much more talented politician, a much smarter, more clever politician? That's one of the dangers that lies ahead. And it's also now incumbent on the Democratic Party, as multiple and pluralistic as it is, to hold itself together, to get along and make something happen, because Joe Biden and his administration has 2 years to make it happen. The Republicans are likely to take back the House in 2022 based on the patterns of history. Well, despite what happened yesterday.
So,
you know, one of the
Stephen, can I just want to actually do, yeah, I just want to ask a question here, because I'm as abhorrent and disgusting and shocking as yesterday was, and it was all of those things plus. I'm never ever going to downplay that. But I also must ask, I mean, in this discussion of the Republican Party, is it possible that we are whipping up some fear here and painting with a very broad brush? And I ask because we spent a dozen hours in all sorts of voter roundtables across this past election season. Mm-hmm. And the brush I think we're painting with right now is too broad. We heard from many different types of Republicans, mm-hmm. who some of whom fit the categories we're talking about, some of whom didn't, and, you know, voted for, they may not have voted for Donald Trump, but voted for a Republican in their state house. I mean, I'm concerned with both grappling with the historic nature of this moment, but also doing it in a way that appreciates the subtleties and the nuances and the textures of the American people.
Yeah. So the genius of Ronald Reagan is marrying this economic freedom and opportunity agenda with bigotry and racial resentment. And what that means is that, yes, there are many members of the Republican Party, both elected officials and people who just vote for Republicans, who are racist and who are white supremacist and who fear the demographic changes that are happening in this country. And that is their motivation to vote for Republicans. But you have, I think, probably just as many, if not more, Republicans who are attracted to the political ideals of the party and like the policies that that Republicans pursue. What's happening now is that those economic conservatives, those people who like conservative judges, are looking the other way from the other right. part of the party. They are excusing it or ignoring it because what they get out of it is important to them. And so I don't think you have to indict every Republican or conservative as a racist to make this point. Mm. I think the point I'm trying to make is that they are all benefiting from not calling out that part of the party, not pushing back against it, because they need it. I mean, they need it desperately to win elections. I mean, yes, they're doing well in Congress, and I think the gerrymander has a ton to do with that, and it has, you know, it reflects the states that they control, you know, because they get to draw those lines. But let's not forget, this is a party that hasn't won a popular contest for president since 2004, and that's the only one that they've won since 1988. It is a party that has gone a longer time without a popular presidential win than any party in our history that survived. And so it is in deep trouble. The changes that are happening in America in terms of who lives here and who has a say in governing this country are not going to stop or even slow. They'll accelerate. And this is a party that because of its association with racial resentment and now racial violence is isolating itself from too mm-hmm. many of those people. It can't survive on a national level without real change.
So, Professor Blight, we've just got about a minute before we take the next break, so I'll give you 30 seconds here.
Okay, well, let's remember there are some issues that are very compelling to Republicans. Anti-tax, anti-abortion, anti-regulation draw many of them in for their votes, whatever the racism is. And there are tax bracket finance Republicans who are not racist. I'm happy to admit that. So they have a lot of issues on their side. It's just that they had a monster at the top of their ticket, and that's why they're in the problem they're in right now.
When we come back, we're going to talk about the problem that has put the entire country in, the entire democracy in, what might happen to that democracy in the coming days and years. So Professor Blight and Stephen Henderson, stand by. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to a special hour of On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're trying to think through how to understand and make sense of all that has happened in the United States in the past 24 hours, or 36 hours, I should say, plus many years that led up to yesterday's moment when an insurrectionist mob attacked the United States Capitol. So let's hear a little bit more of the response to that attack. Here is President-elect Joe Biden addressing the nation this afternoon.
Don't dare call them protesters. They were a riotous mob, insurrectionist, domestic terrorist. It's that basic. It's that simple. And I wish we could say we couldn't see it coming. But that isn't true. We could see it coming.
Of course, this is an event. That's really rocked the nation. That is a cliche, I know, but this is one cliche time where that cliche applies. It has rocked the nation. We've been hearing from listeners from all over the country who've called our message line, which is 617-353-0683, to tell us what they think and what they feel about this moment, what they want for the nation moving forward. So, for example, here's Joyce Ray from Winchester, Virginia. Joyce Ray talked about another incident that happened yesterday. It took place during a peaceful prayer circle at the Luther Place Memorial Church in Washington.
Someone came in and was dressed in some type of fake fur. They reenacted what happened to George Floyd. They invoked the N-word and disrupted the prayer service. So this is going beyond just what happened at the Capitol yesterday.
And I would also add to Joyce Ray's point and say it would went well beyond, because there were also riots or actions that happened at various state houses around the country, which is a fact that I hadn't mentioned yet. And we're seeing responses down at the household level. For example, here's Harris Johnson, who called us from Columbus, Ohio.
The guys that I work with listen to conservative, right-wing, extreme talk shows all day long at work. And the first thing that they did was they went out and they bought more guns at the end of the day after work. And I think that we are woefully unprepared if there is any sort of catastrophic insurrection in the United States. And I think that we have to start using harsh words and harsh actions against these people. Otherwise, there is going to be a terrifying situation in the United States.
And here's 21-year-old Lucas, who told us that yesterday's events are a reality check.
Everything that seems one step away from what will ever happen could be happening tomorrow. It's very easy to think that a mob of thugs will not storm the Capitol when they're confirming the next president. But clearly we're at a point where that will happen. And anything else could possibly happen unless people stand up.
I'm joined today by Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Blight, by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Stephen Henderson. And joining us now is Jason Stanley. He's a professor of philosophy at Yale and author of many books, including How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them, and How Propaganda Works. Jason Stanley, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So if yesterday wasn't a coup in the strict academic sense, or even a failed coup in the strict academic sense, it was a convulsive demonstration of the backsliding of America's democracy. So what happens next when a democracy is backsliding so much?
Well, let me build on the remarks of David and Stephen, who are connecting the ideology that the Republican Party has been building up since Ronald Reagan. And the ideology connects a sort of anti-government libertarianism with racial bigotry. And if you think about how that works, it connects the using dog whistles like welfare, and increasingly, as Brittany Cooper has pointed out, words like public and government itself are linked. These words, the words connecting the government, are linked to bigotry. The idea is public services are for minorities. Government, health insurance, anything public is to be despised because it links diverts our tax money to the so-called undeserved, in other words, Black Americans. And so that makes generations of Republicans connecting government to funneling money to the racial other. And that makes them think that the government themselves is the enemy. And when you think that the government itself is the enemy, well, you're really aligning a movement or creating a movement that is going to undermine the government itself. And what I worry about is this ideology that we've created that represents government itself as the enemy, and government as there to empower supposed Black mobs and cities that are going to take over from real Americans. That's going to lead to insurrection, an insurrection that's going to, of course, benefit those who would benefit those who are taxed highly and the wealthy who want the government off their backs. And that's, I think, the structure we're seeing. And we're seeing an additional element here, which is a kind of cult of the leader that Trump has masterfully taken over. And I'm not sure other politicians are as posed to do that as Trump, maybe a Tucker Carlson. But we've seen a very strong authoritarian element emerge where people crave, as political philosophers since Plato have warned us, people crave a leader to tell them what to do in this time where they're convinced that government itself is the enemy. Mm.
Well, Jason Stanley, I'd like to also just tie it back to the flashpoint of the 2020 election, because I think one of the things that has given extreme velocity to this Democratic backsliding is all the lies around the election count, for example. I mean, we could pick lies from the past 4 years, but specifically around, you know, these completely false claims of any kind of meaningful voter fraud, any kind of voter fraud at all. It's just lies after lies. And in fact, even just the use of that word for, like, today, this morning in the early hours in the House, Congressman Connor Lamb pointed out that many, many lies had been told, even in the House, regarding the election. And that produced so much tension, there was almost a fight, almost a fisticuffs in the House this morning. And those lies are made resilient, almost immortal, by the internet now. So how important is that, the resilience of lies, to the damaging of a democracy?
Truth is central to a democracy. Freedom, the democracy has two values, freedom and equality. You can't have freedom if you're lied to. No one thinks the people of North Korea are free. They might love their leader, but mostly because they've been lied to. And equality requires truth, because equality means the power to speak truth to power. So if you want to smash the heart out of democracy, you go after truth. And the way you do that is you say, look, it's a war. The enemy is horrible. They want to take over your country, your nation, replace you. So truth is just a weapon they're using. I'm going to lie, but I'm lying for you. And this is what happens when you get this dissent from democracy. People lose all sight of the truth, because they're like, I don't care about what's true, because if my guy's lying, at least they're lying for me. And if those guys are telling the truth, well, they're the enemy. It doesn't matter if they're telling the truth. They're just telling the truth to win. So truth is irrelevant. And what you see now is the result of that, that truth is completely irrelevant. It's all about friend versus enemy, which is not democracy. Democracy is about us making policy together, even if we disagree. And you can only do that kind of democratic deliberation if everybody respects the truth. So Trump wisely recognized that and went after truth first and foremost.
Well, so then how do you fight against the imperviousness of those lies, even when, as you're saying, if presented with the truth, people don't care?
Yeah, I don't think a lot of supporters really care about whether what Trump says is true or not. They just think that there's a mortal threat. The liberal elite, the racial minorities in cities, the immigrants. So I think first and foremost, we have to repair America some level of trust, so people can trust each other again and don't view other people as just the fundamental enemy. Because if you view someone as your fundamental enemy, you know, you don't really care about whether they're telling the truth.
Mm. Well, David Blight, let me turn back to you then. And I am seeking examples from history on how on how lies were vanquished by truth.
Huh. Well, it's usually the other way around, isn't it? Well, a lie vanquished by truth. Well, you know, to some degree, what I brought up earlier about the lost cause, there was a time in America when you couldn't grow up in this country and go to a school and not learn that slavery was essentially a benign institution, that the Civil War really wasn't about slavery. It was about something else, like states' rights, tariffs, or railroads. Literally millions grew up on that narrative, that story. Over time, with great changes in history itself and great changes in the study of history, even though there are plenty of people out there who still believe that as a belief, I think it's safe to say most Americans now know that the Civil War was caused by slavery and that slavery was not a benign institution. So the trouble with that is that took generations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that took you know, a world war against racism to begin to fuel a whole new kind of narrative. The problem here is that Trumpist lying has to be, it has to be responded to by the media, by educators, by other politicians. And it's very hard to keep saying, this guy's a liar. This guy's a liar. It's just that, you know, the burden is always on the side that's trying to present legitimate information to make it legitimate. And, you know, Jason was right that one of the great triumphs of Trumpism is to make truth, whether it's from science or whether it's just from some basic empirical history, legitimate.
Yeah. Stephen, I'm going to come to you back to you in a second, but I have kind of almost a practical question for Jason Stanley here, because I agree. I think the country is facing a project of generations, in fact, ahead of us. Mm-hmm. But there's also the immediate concerns about, I mean, as we played at the top of the show, what might happen in the next 14 days or next, yeah, I don't know, several months. Jason Stanley, like, it is, I feel there's also the need for some kind of fire break right now. What would that be?
Yes. I mean, I think that we have to bring accountability back bring accountability back for lying. We saw Cruz and Hawley just open. These are educated people. These are people who know what's true and what's not. And we saw them completely just enter the parallel reality that they know is just completely unhinged. So we have to...
We're going to see if we can get Jason Stanley back. I'm going to be convinced that it's we didn't lose him because he's talking about how to fight lies in the next 14 days. But Stephen, you've been very patient in listening along here.
No, it's been great.
I appreciate that. I do actually want to, I mean, did you care to venture about what, or venture a thought about what you might think needs to happen in the next, now, like 13 days?
Well, I mean, the biggest concern you have now is what the president might do next. My understanding is that while we've been here on the radio, he's delivered some sort of address that seems to walk back some of the things that that happened. And the speculation is that there's some pressure on him from the cabinet to behave a little differently if he wants to hold this seat for the next 13 days and not have to face the 25th Amendment.
Right.
And so,
well, Stephen, let me just jump in here because you are right. The president has been speaking or spoke a little bit in a video message. We have a little clip of that. Here's Donald Trump.
The demonstrators who infiltrated the Capitol have defiled the seat of American democracy. To those who engaged in the acts of violence and destruction, you do not represent our country. And to those who broke the law, you will pay. We have just been through an intense election, and emotions are high. But now tempers must be cooled and calm restored. We must get on with the business of America.
That's a clip from a video that Donald Trump just released. And
but Meghna, the problem is he's one of the criminals.
Yes.
And there has to be – we have laws and institutions – that can be used right now. And obviously, the 25th Amendment is one of them. What I heard him saying there is, please back off. Don't use the 25th on me. I'll be a good boy. But he's already committed the crime, and it was yesterday.
Yeah. Well, Jason Stanley, we've got 30 seconds. I think we've got you back here. Just want to give you a last thought.
I think we've destroyed all sense of accountability for lying. We've destroyed all sense of accountability for past behavior. We saw that with the Supreme Court and the Republicans with the rushing through of the last Supreme Court appointment. So we've lost all sense of sort of consistency over time. People can do one thing one day and the opposite the other day. That's what Trump has just done. And then we just forget about it. So we have to restore that. We have to restore a sense that people have a history and there's accountability for what people have done. And until that, we won't have democracy back.
Well, Jason Stanley is a professor of philosophy at Yale and author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stephen Henderson, host of WDET's Detroit Today and executive editor at Bridge Detroit. Stephen, it's always great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Magna.
And David Blight, professor of history at Yale and Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Next time I'm going to ask you for a Frederick Douglass quote, Professor Blight, but thank you for joining us today.
Honored to be here. Thanks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.